Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, host Jessica Thomas talks with professor, author, and sometimes host of Jaws of Justice Radio, Dr. J. Renee, about her book, Navigating the Criminal Justice System, a guide for anyone going through the system and the people who love them. From arrest to court and even into prison, there are things that we all need to know. Then, after the break, host Latara Smith talks with Reggie Griffin and Anthony Williams. Both men spent years in the Missouri Penitentiary and have received no compensation after they were exonerated of the crimes they were convicted of. They speak about their struggle to get ahead and the need for a conviction integrity unit in Missouri. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Coming up next is Jessica Thomas and her guest, Dr. J. Renee.
Good morning and welcome to the Jaws of Justice. I'm Jessica Thomas. With me in the studio, Dr. J. Renee. And Dr. J., as you are known to your students because you teach at a university, is also an author and producer of Jaws of Justice programming, but you've recently written a book called Navigating the Criminal Justice System, a Guide for Anyone Going Through the System and the People That Love Them. And it's kind of like about time, but I want you to tell our listeners, first of all, you know, what brought you to writing this book? Did you yourself have experience coming from? What brought you into criminology? Did you yourself have a lot of street experience?
Thank you, Jessica. I'm so glad to be here with you. And yes, talk about my experiences, my book. I got involved with the juvenile justice system at a very early age. I probably just turned about 13 years old. And I got put into the criminal justice system. Not so much my idea, of course, but I learned a lot of lessons, and it was.
So, were you just getting in trouble as a kid? Skipping school.
I got into some trouble, but actually, what got me put into the criminal justice system was more family problems and issues related to that. Once you get into the system, it's very hard to get out, and so. Yeah, that was my experience.
So were you a runaway, and maybe were you in, like, juvenile in?
I had ran away.
It's like incarceration, but they don't call it incarcerated because you're a kid.
I had run away. I had a couple of shoplifting charges, and then combined with problems at home where it just wasn't a really great environment at the time.
So you end up in group home?
They put me into a lower level kind of group home.
Structured
they actually called it a foster home, but it was a group home setting with staff. And I got in trouble for stealing some mail, actually.
Wow.
You know, I was 13 years old. And
that starts your journey into
the system. Yeah, and I found out, hey, that's a federal offense. And it actually landed me in maximum security with females who were in there for murder and rape and a lot of other serious offenses. I think that's where I first started doing kind of research and becoming a sociologist or a criminologist.
Your experience.
Yeah, I started looking at the system, looking at the people in the system, looking at the processes, experiencing
Yeah, and
that.
During this, though, but you know, a lot of people don't make it out of the system and they're still in the system. How did you find your way out? What got you interested in education as opposed to criminals? I mean, you know, getting into criminal activity.
You know, much like many other women, I got pregnant. And that was actually a key turning point for me, having children, wanting to be better for somebody, having somebody that pushed me to want to be a better person and to live a better life. And then education. You know, I started working in the community once I figured out I wanted to be better. I wanted to help everybody be better.
Right.
And I was working in the community, and I realized that I didn't have enough just with my own personal information, my own knowledge, and it really drove me to go back to school. And it was actually here in Kansas City at Penn Valley Community College.
Right.
A professor by the name of Dr. Curls, who actually just encouraged me to keep coming back. And I did. And, you know, it's been a long journey. I've had several professors along the way who have motivated me and encouraged me.
All the way to being a doctor.
Yeah. And so I got my GED when I was 16, uh-huh. fresh out of maximum security, and now I have a PhD in juvenile justice, and it's really a blessing to be able to study this system, to be able to teach about this system that I did, you know, have so many experiences with personally.
You know, I had done several interviews dealing with post-traumatic stress after being in prison and things, And one thing I would say is they don't really issue a handbook like, so your loved one went to prison and they're coming home. This is what to expect. And because there's such a deep, so to get something like you're saying, a guidebook for people going through the system.
And
what are some of the things you touch on in there that would be a guidebook?
Well, yeah, you're very correct. We don't get a guidebook. And so one of the things I found out that I experienced the system myself, I studied the system for many, many years, and I've also had a lot of friends and family members and loved ones who go through the system. And I can tell you, and as a community member, right?
I think if a parent knew, okay, that they would have to bring their child's child to visit them in prison, mm-hmm. and what they would be subjected to get through those doors to get to your incarcerated loved one, that parents would perhaps think twice or three times or four times even before they let their kid hang around with that sketchy other kid. If they knew what was in store for them, because going to visit someone in jail is not a pleasant process for someone who has never had any encounter with anyone in law.
Is that something
you cover in there?
I do. I talk about all of those experiences, both from the perspective of someone who's going through the system, as well as from the perspective of the loved ones, mm-hmm. those people who are kind of walking through this process with them. I talk about the PTSD coming out of this system. And you're right, a lot of people will experience post-traumatic symptoms related to going through that criminal justice system
process. Well, think about environment. 24 hours a day, light. Not sunlight, but lights. Noise, the noise level. And just because of the designs of buildings, you're going to have a loudness in the acoustics. Loudness and anger because people aren't happy in there. No matter what kind of day you're having, you're not happy to be in prison.
Well, there are a lot of different experiences, but even for people who may not ever make it to prison, for instance, my daughter, one time we were pulled over and the police pulled her out of the car and handcuffed her, and I think she had just turned 17. I noticed that event traumatized her, yeah. right? So even after experiencing an arrest, mm-hmm. right, people can be traumatized based on that experience. And then what happens the next time a police officer gets behind them, right? So in this book, I talk about beginning with an arrest, right? And we go through and we look at what is this process? What happens? What are some of my rights? What should I do when I'm pulled over, when I'm arrested? Was I even arrested? Maybe you weren't arrested and you just think you were, mm-hmm. right? I talk about the court system. Dealing with the court system, that can be a very long and tedious process. And I'm not an attorney.
You talk about the process of bonding, even just getting out of jail. How do you remember a phone number to call anyone?
And, you know, one of the good things is because of technology and police are well aware that we don't really have phone numbers. They'll let you usually get a phone number out of your cell phone. So usually, yes, you'll be allowed to make that first phone call. They'll try to help you get a hold of someone or make contact. And I talk about all those issues, bonding issues. Do you want to bond this person out of jail, or is it maybe better that they stay a couple days and wait until their first court appearance? Maybe you don't have the money to bond them out of jail necessarily, and maybe that money should go towards helping with the lawyer. So there are a lot of different things to think about as you go through that process. And then, you know, after court, you're going to have to deal with corrections if you've been found guilty. That may mean community-based corrections. You may be dealing with probation and parole. I discussed those concepts. You may end up having to serve time in a facility that may be a prison. So I talk about all that. And then we finish up the text talking about, you know, what is it like coming out for the individual? And what is it like for the loved ones who are dealing with a family member who is kind of coming out of the system and trying to change their experiences so that they don't end up going back?
And the recidivism rate. Do you address in the book about what goes on in the prisons themselves? Or is that something that's standard pretty much across the corrections industry?
Well, I talk a lot about what someone might experience going into prison. There's definitely a prison culture. It's a good thing to know, you know, there are differences between, you know, county jails, city jails, state prisons, and federal prisons.
Have you seen that film? It's a comedy. Will Ferrell, I know, is one of the actors.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to hire this guy. He assumes, because he's black and cleaning his car, that he's got a criminal. He's been to prison.
Yeah.
And let's get hard.
Kevin
get
Hart.
Hard,
yeah.
Right? But that concept of going to prison, I mean, is that?
I mean, I think there's...
Would this book prepare you for that?
Yes, I think I do a good job, and I try to explain some of the things you need to be aware of. Like I said, I've had...
The culture.
Yeah, and there is. And when you go into prison, there are definitely some mistakes you do not want to make. You do not want to be taking items from other people, accepting gifts that you think maybe people are just being friendly, and you will end up paying for those in ways you probably never imagined. So you do have to be careful. You have to be aware of what's going on when you go in so that you don't make some kind of key mistakes that people make.
You know, it sounds like you're not protected in there, but aren't you surrounded by police? Wouldn't you be protected, like, safer there than anywhere?
Well, one of the things I mentioned is you have to be really careful because you don't know if it's going to be the guards or the inmates. And the reality is, in those environments, at one time or another, it'll probably be some of everybody who tries to test you, who pushes you, who may try to hustle you or abuse you. And so that is just very common. And just because someone is wearing a uniform, unfortunately, doesn't mean that they're safe.
Let our listeners know that you're listening to the Jaws of Justice radio program. And I am Jessica Thomas. My guest is Dr. J. Renee, and we're discussing her book, Navigating the Current or the Criminal Justice System, a guide for anyone going through the system and the people that love them.
Yes, thank you, Jessica.
You're really welcome.
And so this book kind of discusses all of that and gives you some things to be aware of specifically when you're in that situation so that you kind of don't make some key mistakes.
You're a very positive role model where you can draw from a circumstance and come out of it as a resume point, a resume builder, honestly. Yeah. And that's honestly the kind of things going forward that people need to know. You can just burn that past. It doesn't change it, but you just learn that lesson, come forward, and go from it. I know, like, recently the president had banned on federal job applications the felony box.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's been lifted I know like Walmart has, and it probably hasn't off of general employment, but that's going to make an effect as well.
Yeah, and I talk about that. There's more of an effort to push the, you know, ban the box, asking about prior criminal records, or at least, you know, trying to make it make sense. You know, some places will ask, have you ever been convicted of a crime, any crime in your whole life? Some may ask just about felonies. Some may ask about the last 7 years. Some may ask 10 years. So, you know, it would be nice to have some kind of logistic consistency across the board about what employers are able to ask. And then, you know, how far does that go? Because right now, unfortunately, even though we incarcerate more people than any other nation in the world, we have a lot of people who like to turn their noses down at people that have experienced the system. And it's unfortunate because it becomes this us versus them dichotomy, which isn't real in today's society.
Well, not only that, but if you look at it by race and the percentages of race as opposed to another race as having more likely to have spent time incarcerated.
Yeah.
Just like the movie we're saying. This white guy assumed this black guy had done time just because he assumed that had happened. So you're going to look at a larger population that's going to have this experience.
Yeah, proportionately speaking.
What it does to the fact that this is an adult who may or may not be a parent, but if they are a parent, they're not being an influence in their child's life.
Well, they are being influenced, but what kind of influence?
Exactly.
Right. And
so what do you see for like the opportunities for education or what would they call it when you're trying to rehab? Yeah. Rehabilitation. What do you see that?
Well,
right, currently, do you see an upswing in new programs designed to?
No. I mean, I'm a big proponent of restorative justice. Mm-hmm. So I see new restorative justice programs popping up and kind of pushing towards that. I see more advocacy happening. But, you know, the reality is we still don't treat, we punish in the criminal justice system. And I think that's an important concept for people and loved ones to understand. We may want our loved ones to get treatment. That's not really what the criminal justice system is about. It's about punishing. And yeah, unfortunately, where we are as a society, we're just not in a phase where we're pushing a lot of money towards rehabilitation and treatment. We're still in this correctional phase, and we spend a lot of money locking people up.
So. It seems that way. It truly does. It's an industry of private prisons or private or policing for profit.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings into question the school to prison pipeline.
Well, yeah,
and
I mean,
you set
know,
up that mentality.
We currently use, I think it's fourth grade standardized test scores to predict needed bedsides in prison. So this is our formula for determining. And it's sad because on one hand, we're not investing in the education of our students like we should be, but we are continually investing in prisons and bed space there. I do think you'll see some of this start to change. And I said this before the recession hit. And, you know, it takes a lot of money to keep this business going. And I think we're seeing some reversals now. But, again, we still incarcerate at a greater rate than any other democratic nation in the world. So
we are not democratic at all. The highest prison population
exactly.
For being a free and open democracy, which is truly, yeah, that we're severely limited in our pursuit of happiness, that's for sure.
Exactly.
and pretty regulated. But do you think, you know, changes in the family dynamics even now, because there is such a large percentage of people who have probably never experienced or don't even know anyone that's had a whole, like what we would say, a traditional family.
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel that that dynamic can be preserved, the family dynamic can be preserved with an individual being incarcerated?
Oh, definitely. And I think that my book definitely encourages the continual bonding of that individual. So we don't want to break those bonds, those familial bonds between an individual who may have to go serve a prison sentence and their loved ones. We find that the research finds that it's very important to maintain those relationships for both parties, not just the offender, not just the family members, but it's really important to keep those bonds in place, to keep those relationships, and it can be hugely supportive for both parties. So, you know, that's one of my concerns, and I talk about this, having your lawyers and your family members advocate for placement, right? Because if your loved one is sent 5 hours away,
they could have an influence.
And you can have an influence. And that's the thing I don't think people realize, that you can have a huge influence in your loved one's case. Like we've seen loved ones advocate for their family members until they've been freed from prison. So you can have a huge impact. And even if you don't have an impact on that level, you may have the ability to impact where they're going to be located, right? If you're calling the warden, if you're calling the administration and saying, I don't feel like my child's safe there, I want him in another facility, right? So there are different things you can do to advocate for your loved one while they are going through that process. From the very beginning, even, you know, when you first, those initial court appearances, all of that can be very helpful.
And about the healing process that happens afterward, I would like to take a moment to remind our listeners that you've been listening to an interview with Dr. J. Renee, and we're discussing her book, Navigating the Criminal Justice System, A Guide for Anyone Going Through the System and the People That Love Them. And Jay Reddy, I'd like to thank you so much for coming in, but I wanted to ask you one final question. How long did this book take you to write?
Well, I would say it's taken me my whole life to gather the information. I actually just started kind of developing my ideas within the last couple years, and I probably spent 4 or 5 months, maybe 6 months, actually writing, and then a few months editing and going through that process as well.
Which was quite a whole learning thing in itself.
Yeah, it really took a lifetime of experiences, though, to kind of put into this book. I'm looking at it from so many different perspectives.
When will it be available? Is it currently available?
It is available. You can go to my website, drjrenee.com. That's drjrenee.com. Again, drjrenee.com, drjrenee.com. And it's also available on Amazon and Kindle in ebook version, some of the other e-formats.
Cool. Is it on a hard copy yet?
Yeah. You can order it.
And they send it to your house?
Yes.
You can people order still it
from
read
my
books?
Website. Of course.
Right?
I still love hard copies of everything.
So. And it really sounds like it's something that really could pertain and ascertain. A lot of people's lives are touched by the justice system. We're all in it.
The criminal justice system has really affected a lot of people, and unfortunately, when I start thinking about it, there just wasn't any good navigational guide that I could access in one place. So I really hope this will speak to the readers and give them something they can value.
I do believe it will. I'd like to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jessica. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Dr. J. Renee on the Jaws of Justice, 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City.
Now the calendar for February 8th, 2016. Mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, February 13th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. The current Douglas County, Kansas prosecutor and former Jackson County, Missouri prosecutor Amy McGowan has been removed from a case in Douglas County after several acts of misconduct in various Kansas criminal cases. The KC Freedom Project is looking to establish a persistent pattern of misconduct by Ms. McGowan. If you or a loved one was charged with a criminal offense in the 16th Circuit Court of Jackson County, Missouri, or in Douglas County, Kansas, in which Amy McGowan served as a prosecutor, and you feel there were questionable actions by the prosecution in the case, please call our complaint hotline number 816-844-3100 and leave your case details. All complaints will be turned over to the FBI Civil Rights Division for investigation. My name's Casey Rausch, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Next week on Jaws of Justice Radio, Jeff Humfield moderates a panel on gun violence with Dr. Rex Archer of the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department, Judy Sherry of Grandparents Against Gun Violence, and Lauren Stanton of the Northeast Kansas Brady Campaign Against Gun Violence, and your calls. Coming up is Latara and her guests, Reggie Griffin and Anthony Williams.
Hi, my name is Latara Smith, and I'm with the KC Freedom Project. We're here on the radio today, and I have a couple of really awesome guests that we're interviewing in reference to wrongful convictions here within the state of Missouri. I have two individuals here who were wrongly convicted, and they had their cases overturned, which most definitely was a blessing. So let me move forward and introduce, I have Mr. Reggie Griffin. Mr. Griffin served over 30 years in prison in the Missouri Department of Corrections, correct, Mr. Griffin?
31 years.
31 years. And you not just didn't serve time within the Missouri Department of Corrections, but you also served time on death row, correct?
Yes, ma'am. I spent over 7 years on death row.
For a murder that you did not commit?
That's correct.
Okay, okay. We'll be back to discuss that more specifically in detail. But I also have on the line Mr. Anthony Williams. Mr. Williams was also wrongly convicted and served approximately 20 or 21 years within the Missouri Department of Corrections for first-degree murder, which is a murder that he didn't commit. Mr. Williams, thank you for being able to interview with us today. It's a blessing to have you as well.
Thank you for having me, ma'am.
Now, Mr. Williams, you went in as a juvenile, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
How old were you when you were wrongly convicted of first-degree murder?
I was 14 years old.
14 years old.
In, yes, ma'am.
Sent to the Department of Corrections at 14 years old, and it took you 20 years to get your case overturned.
That's right.
Wow, that's a lot. 20 years to get your case overturned. So you basically went in a baby and came out an adult, a grown man.
Yes, ma'am.
Wow, okay. And then Mr. Griffin, now your situation, you actually were incarcerated for a different charge, and during your time of incarceration, that's when you caught this false murder charge, correct?
I was in the Missouri Training Center for Men, and an event occurred on the yard, and they...
When you say they, who do you mean?
The prison officials locked the prison down and did whatever they did. And on the evening of the murder, I was in my cell, and two guards came to my door and told me that they had orders from up front to lock me up, and I asked them lock me up for what they told me. They didn't know. They just were doing what they was told to do. So they took me out of my cell, took me to an ad sick, placed me in ad sick. A few days later, I was taken before a committee, and at which time they told me I was being investigated for the homicide that happened on the yard a few days ago. I in turn told them that I had nothing to do with it. As a matter of fact, I wasn't even on the yard when it occurred.
You weren't even on the yard?
No.
Okay. Wow.
So they transferred me from the Missouri Training Center for Men to Jefferson City Correctional Center, where I was placed in a special management unit, and subsequently I completed the special management unit program, which I spent 3 years over there. And upon me completing the special management unit program, I was returned to general population. This was in 83, and in 88, they took me out to Randolph County Courthouse and charged me with capital murder. 1 year later, I was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. I was subsequently sent to death row, and at the time, death row was in Jefferson City. After a couple of years being on death row in Jefferson City, they moved death row to Potosi Correctional Center, where I was transferred to continuously being on death row, fighting my appeal. After being there approximately maybe 3 or 4 years at Potosi, the death sentence was overturned because they used another person's conviction with my name as the aggravating circumstance. So the Missouri Supreme Court took away the death sentence and resentenced me to life without parole. I continue to appeal my conviction of the life without parole, which took a substantial amount of time to get the courts to see it and understand that I was not the person that committed the murder. During my 2915 hearing, my co-defendant came out there and testified that he committed the murder along with another individual, and mm-hmm. that this other individual had got caught with one of the weapons that they used to do the crime with. So they said that, well, we don't believe you.
Okay, so let me stop you right there and ask you a question. You actually had an individual come forward and said, hey, I did this.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so how long was it after when this individual came forward and said, I did this? How long did it take you after that before you were actually, this case was actually overturned and you were set free?
Probably another 25 years.
Wow. Wow.
They said that they didn't believe that he was telling the truth, that he was only trying to help me. So he in turn told them that the person that was with him got caught with the other weapon moments after they committed the crime.
So knowing that, was information withheld? Is that what happened? Or how did they not know?
The guy that got caught with the other weapon, they didn't charge him with murder. They only charged him with possession of a weapon inside of an institution.
Which
okay?
is contraband.
Right.
Okay.
They didn't connect it that this guy had just committed the assault, being that he had got caught with a weapon, okay?
Right.
They didn't even look into that. They just figured, like, once they had locked me up along with a couple of other guys, that they had who they wanted. So I, in turn, kept fighting my case, kept pursuing it, and finally first they would, like, give me hearings, and then they would, like, deny them.
Right. And we've seen that happen quite a bit here in Jackson County. But go ahead, because your case was actually out of St. Louis, correct?
Well, I'm from St. Louis, but the case happened in Mobley.
Mobley, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so I was in Randolph County.
When it happened? That's where you were incarcerated at the time?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So to fast forward, the attorney, I hired an appeal attorney by the name of Kent Gibson, and he was looking into my case. And so he filed a writ of habeas corpus in DeKalb County, mm-hmm. which is in Cameron.
Right.
The judge in DeKalb County gave me a hearing on the Rule 91.
Right.
And he said that after we had the hearing, he would rule on it within 90 days. After about 8 months, because I went to court in August, he didn't rule on it until like March.
Okay.
At which turn he wrote up an opinion. Well, actually, the attorney general wrote the opinion and the judge just signed it, okay?
Okay.
Which was not the proper thing to do.
Right, right, right. But that's a complaint. We see that happens quite often, but go ahead.
So after that appeal was denied, my attorney, Ken Gibson, filed a petition with the Missouri Supreme Court, which is the court that overturned the murder conviction, okay?
Okay.
Because of the withholding other evidence of the weapon that Jeffrey Smith was caught with.
Okay. So then, did your prosecutor that, who withheld the evidence? Was it the prosecutor or
The local prosecutor along with the attorney general, because the attorney general and the local prosecutor prosecuted the case.
But so they were aware?
Well, they had to be aware because they charged him with a weapon.
Right, right.
5 minutes after someone was killed.
Right, right, right.
And you never looked into it to see if it was connected to the case?
When the prosecutors withheld information like they did in your case, that was actual prosecutorial misconduct, and those prosecutors should have been held responsible for that behavior. I don't know if you ever, you know, filed a complaint or your legal team did, but most definitely that was a form of prosecutorial misconduct, and that prosecutor should have been held accountable. Mr. Williams, tell me a little bit about your situation and what happened. Like I said, you were 14 years old when you were charged with first-degree murder. Just kind of, you know, tell us just a briefing about it, and if there was any issues in your case where evidence was withheld or if there was any prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, in 1993, I attended a fundraising dance in St. Louis City, and it was a bunch of teens, and a fight happened in the dance, and I got involved in the fight along with numerous other teens, and after the fight, you know, basically the people that weren't able to calm down were asked to leave, and everybody else, including myself, continued to stay at the dance. And basically, at the end of the night, around midnight, the dance ended, and everyone was outside waiting for their rides. And somebody started shooting. You know, everybody, you know, started running and ducking. People were running back into the building, and myself and a couple of my friends, we ran in the opposite direction, you know, and away from the shots, and were able to get away and not get, you know, shot that night.
Well, let me ask you something, Mr. Williams. How did they put this crime on you? Did you have a weapon? Was it said that you had a weapon? How did they put this crime on you?
Well, basically, the crime was put on me because I was involved in the fight that night, you know, and like it was numerous teams that was actually fighting that night. But the police, they were told that the fight was evolved around two people, and and that was the guy's brother who was murdered, and another guy, they initially looked into the other guy who all the stuff was about and who had been had animosity with the kid that got killed and all this stuff.
Well, let me ask you this so we can kind of get.
They didn't do a thorough investigation.
Okay.
The main witness in the case, you know what I'm saying, he identified one kid, and then they did a cursory look into that. And then they didn't look no further into that. And then the same kid identified myself, you know what I'm saying? And then they started looking at me. And then they asked me to come down for a lineup, you know. And I went down for a lineup. And when I go to the lineup, they had two girls identify me in the lineup as eyewitnesses, but they were not eyewitnesses. They were just girls that saw me fighting. Mm-hmm. Had them pick me out but they put them in a lineup and had them pick me out and to ask them to identify the person y'all see shooting, and seen fighting, and they picked me, and then they wrote in the report that the girls were eyewitnesses. And that enabled them to hold me long enough to get people to get other witnesses to come down there and then point me out. So like it was a lot of lineup problems with the way that I initially got arrested and identification problems in the beginning that really led to all of this.
So basically in your situation it was a misidentification, which is, you know, what the Saudi defense, some other dude did it, basically it wasn't you. And so yours was misidentification. I know that you did over, 20 years in prison, and I want to get to this. I wanted to hear a little bit about y'all's cases and let the people hear exactly what happened to you guys. But this is what I really want to get to before we run out of time, and that is the fact that you guys were wrongly convicted. Mr. Griffin, in your case, it was a withholding of evidence, which was for sure, you know, from the prosecutors, you know, as you say.
The Brady claim.
Right, it fell under the Brady violation. And then in your case, Mr. Williams, it was misidentity.
No, ma'am. Mine was Brady also, ma'am.
Okay.
Like, all that stuff ended up being Brady like his, because it was stuff that the prosecutor knew happened in the beginning that we found out in the end wasn't revealed. But that's how I initially got accused of murder wrongfully.
But that's exactly what I was getting ready to go into. If there was things that were withheld, witnesses that they didn't mention, things that brought up, that too is a form of a Brady violation that falls on the prosecutors. And you know, I know exactly what you're saying. But this is what I want to get to: the fact that you guys served all of this time in prison, and neither of you have been compensated any financial compensation from the state of Missouri or from the counties that are responsible, the prosecutors that work for the counties, if they withheld evidence and they're responsible for these wrongful convictions, then why aren't the counties being held accountable to compensate you guys in some form, shape, or fashion, as well as the state of Missouri? And that's what I wanted to pull out today. So, Mr. Griffin, have you been compensated for any of the 30 years, the 7 years that you were on death row for your wrongful conviction?
I have not been compensated. I have not even been given an apology.
Wow. What about you, Mr. Williams? Have you been compensated in any form, shape, or fashion?
No, ma'am. I haven't been compensated at all. If it don't be for do-gooders out here that wanted to help me make this transition back into society, I don't know how I would have been able to make it, you know, with no help at all.
Okay, because see, and that's what this is about. We're in the process of writing, you know, putting together a bill to present. Hopefully we'll get someone to present this bill about compensation for the wrongly convicted here in Missouri. You know, we don't have that here, but we want something like
Texas.
Like Texas has. You know, they have the Tim Cole, and, you know, I know a little bit about the Tim Cole Act, but I do know that in that particular case, his family was allotted compensation, and that's actually, his mother was very proactive about pushing the bill and getting these things to happen. So that's what we need to do here in Missouri. We need to come together. I know I've briefly been in conversation with Alvin Sykes about let's put a bill together to push not just this issue of no compensation for the wrongly convicted, but also for the implementation of conviction integrity units. Because had there been a conviction integrity unit in Randall County or Mobley, where you were convicted, one in St. Louis, Mr. Williams, which is where I believe you fell out of, and then as well here, Jackson County, Missouri, it would be very beneficial, because it would allow an individual to release from prison without all of this long time in litigation, going before filing this appeal, that appeal, 2915s, Rule 91s, all these other things, federal habeases and all these things, when we can just go right back to the prosecutor's office and say, listen, this is what happened. This is what, you know, you understand what I'm saying?
I understand
saying?
Exactly
Address
what you're saying.
Address this issue here. It's kind of like a case we have ongoing here in Jackson County, you know, with the Keith Carnes case. You know, look and just look at what happened in this case. You know, and just make your wrong a right and overturn this case. So,
well, I'm well aware of the fact that they know what's going on, and they knew what was going on, because when I went back to the county jail, and you have to really start the proceedings over, and we had to get discovery again, and during the discovery, we found out that the state had did a secret investigation in 2005. Where they sent the state investigator to talk to the state's witness that testified against me, And the state witness told the state investigator that everything he testified to at my trial was a lie.
Okay. Wow. Mr. Williams, go ahead. We have about 2 minutes left.
Well, I was just going to say this, ma'am. I was just going to say, you know, I don't think it's any question when someone is released like we are due to prosecutors withholding evidence.
Right.
That is unquestionable. You know what I'm saying? They don't just let people just concede to that easily. Like, they fight all the way to the end. You know, so it when you see a few that are fortunate enough for people to drum up so much support and all that type of stuff to actually bring this stuff out, because like it's so many people still in there that suffering from this stuff that like it, you know, it probably to get Reggie out, it might have took 10, 15 people working in concert.
And you
can't just get those years back.
Right. Oh, I know.
You can't just get those years back. You know, those years don't come back. I've been home 2 years and I'm looking at how much stuff I could have accomplished in all those years that I could have been building on my credit and doing things like that. Like, I'm just starting from scratch.
Right.
At 35, 36 years old. And like, I ain't got nothing, and I'm gonna make it.
That's right, and you
that's
sure
why,
are.
And that's why I'm trying to start the business that I'm starting. You know, Missouri
right.
Prisoner Advocacy Consulting.
Right, right,
LLC,
right. And we're
because
gonna
I wanna be able to advocate for people like me and Reggie. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
To get, you know what I'm saying, compensation, as well as I want to be able to advocate for juveniles and stuff like that.
Right.
Be able to help people and use my experience.
You know, and I know what you want to do and what your mission is, and I just so, you know, I think that is awesome. And we're actually going to have you back on the show to actually talk about your plans. But I want to say this here, that I do understand how it's hard. You've got to come out and put your life back together, both of you guys. You know, I can only imagine. But working in reentry, I understand for sure, you know, the difficulties it is to come out of prison and you know, try to get it all together again after someone has missed, you know, multiple years of being out of society. And now you're just put back out there, you know, yeah. Boop, here you go. But I want to say this here. And it's sad because, like you said, Mr. Williams, they take you through so much just to make their wrong a right. And that falls back on,
it takes so much.
Let me tell you, that falls back on our prosecutor. Who do we have as a head prosecutor? If that he or she doesn't have the heart to do what's right by God's people, if she doesn't have the heart to do what's right, that's when we need to be getting prosecutors out of office that will not right wrongs that they know have taken place and not cover these wrongs. But I do believe that we're about out of time for the show. Mr. Griffin, I want to thank you for coming and interviewing with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Mr. Williams, I want to thank you as well for coming up. And this is not over. We're going to have more parts to this show. I just want everyone to know that. But coming up next is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following segment comes to us courtesy of the Asbury Park Press out of New Jersey.
I think it's shocking that our country is still putting people in cages for a plant. I was supporting John Podito, who's facing 10 to 30 years for cannabis. He grew 17 plants, and he's going to jail for something that I'm using right here with impunity because I'm a patient, and he's facing 10 to 30 years.
John Podito didn't think there was anything wrong with growing 17 marijuana plants in the Pinelands, but a jury thought otherwise. And on Friday, the Mays Landing man was before a judge to be sentenced for the crime.
Sure he grew the plants. Sure he smoked it. Probably, Judge, he didn't plead. Probably we're here, and he didn't take advantage of this man's generosity and the court's understanding and take the plea because he didn't have the presence of mind because he was forever gone on the drugs that he created and brought into this world. He said he sold some, but I bet you he smoked more than he sold by a long shot. He came to court. You know when he quit smoking dope, Judge? October the 28th. The verdict came back in this case October the 29th. He was coked up during the whole trial.
First of all, he's a wonderful, kind, and loving son. I have three sons, and I'm very proud of him. Even now, in the jam that he's in, and the bleak future that he's looking at,
all of you need to learn a lot more about marijuana, because the laws certainly do not reflect the reality of the country you live in, where tens of millions of people, as we speak now, are doing it freely and peacefully in this country without any interference from judges, prosecutors, law enforcement of any kind. And if, in fact, everybody in this country lived the life myself and my girlfriend have led, the peaceful life we led, we wouldn't even need law enforcement or judges or prosecutors anymore. So just understand, all of you, we are the most peaceful people in this country, and that will never change regardless of the sentence I get.
Your defense, if you were this, as you see yourself, this spokesperson, as some of your misguided supporters call you, a zealot, a fighter for a cause, if your defense was supposed to be something that were to help your believed cause, in my opinion, it was short-sighted, it was inept, it was reckless, and it was foolhardy. I sentence you to 8 years in New Jersey State's prison.
8 years for 17 plants. Ain't that America? Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.